Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As we go to air Thursday morning, Illinois has reported another 2,200 confirmed cases of COVID-19, plus 92 more deaths. That brings the state's total to more than 50,000 known cases and 2,215 lives lost. Meanwhile, a small but vocal opposition to Governor J.B. Pritzker's stay-at-home orders continues, with Republican State Representative John Cabello from McChesney Park filing another lawsuit to block enforcement of the orders. Unlike an earlier filing by one of his Republican colleagues, Cabello wants to undo the order for everyone in Illinois. He says Pritzker has exceeded his authority under law. A spokeswoman for the governor says the suit shows a, quote, callous disregard for science, reason, and the value of human life. Later on today's show, we'll take a bit of a break from COVID-19 so we can talk with Vivian McConnell, a Chicago-based singer-songwriter who performs as VV Lightbody. McConnell grew up in Dixon and joins us for a conversation and a live performance. And when the coronavirus threatened to delay the wedding of a Chicago couple, they took their ceremony virtual, inviting nearly 80 friends to a Zoom wedding. But first, the COVID-19 pandemic is putting a strain on many marriages and other domestic partnerships. Our first guest today says the average marriage will suffer, but some relationships will benefit. Eli Finkel is a social psychologist and professor at Northwestern University. He's also the author of The All or Nothing Marriage, and he joins me now. Eli Finkel, welcome back to the 21st.
Delighted to be here.
Before we get into the coronavirus aspect of all this, I want to begin by talking about the very idea of analyzing relationships or marriage therapy. Is this a modern idea? Did people in other eras worry about the quality of their relationships the same way we do today?
Well, I wouldn't say in the same way, but yeah, people always worried about this stuff. I mean, this is the stuff that preoccupied people like Plato and Aristotle. I mean, the how humans connect to other humans has always been big. The primacy of the romantic relationship or the marriage, that has gained a great deal of currency. And I think we're at the moment where, nobody's ever cared quite as much about that one relationship as we do today.
And have our expectations of marriage changed?
Radically. And here you don't have to go back to Plato. I wrote this book a few years ago called The All or Nothing Marriage. And what I tried to do in that book, at least at the front end of the book, is plot how marriage has changed over time. And one of the things that I think is fun about that is it's hard for us when we're born into a particular historical or cultural context to realize how arbitrary or idiosyncratic a lot of our assumptions are. And so if you were to go back even just a couple hundred years, consider when Abraham Lincoln was born in 1809, he was born into a one-room dirt floor log cabin. He had an older sister and the parents, and they all lived there. And then there was a kid who came after but died in infancy, and then his sister, Abraham's sister, died when she was still a teenager, giving birth to a stillborn child. And that's what life was like. Life was fragile and precarious. And so the idea that, you might want to marry for love and you wouldn't marry somebody if you didn't get the butterflies in the belly, it would have struck people in your, little colonial hamlet as ridiculous.
And so given that our expectations and what we want out of marriage now has changed, there's more pressure, right, on marriages and relationships than we used to have?
Yes, but in an interesting way. It's not quite as straightforward as that. And you're building on an idea that I think is pretty common, which is we sort of scold people for asking so much. We shouldn't ask so much of our marriage and so much of our relationship. And honestly, when I first set out to write that book on marriage, that's where I thought I was going to end up. What's interesting is that in Abraham Lincoln's parents' day, they literally looked to the marriage for survival. When I say that, I mean literally food, clothing, shelter. They created the candles that lit their, little house in the evening time, right? And so people looked to marriage and to the, the children on the farm to produce the things required to survive. And so we're asking much less of our marriage today than we did in the past about the things that you might think of as lower down Maslow's hierarchy, basic survival sorts of things. What's really changed is we're asking so much more in terms of psychological and emotional fulfillment. We want to love our partner. That's been the case, at least going back to around 1850 or whatever else. And more recently, love isn't enough. People are willing to leave a relationship where there's real warmth and affection if they feel stagnant. And these days, we want love from our marriage, but also this sense of self-expression, of personal growth, this sense of living our most authentic life.
Okay, before we get too much into the what we want out of modern marriages, I want to stay with the past for a little bit longer. And, you know, as we're talking about what marriage used to look like, let's go maybe not to Abraham Lincoln's day, but just 100 years ago, particularly during the Spanish flu, as it was called then, the flu pandemic of 1918 to 1920. What would have been expectations on a marriage then as compared to today?
Well, they would have expected a lot less in terms of this sort of self-expression and personal growth and authenticity. That really started to become widespread around the 1960s. Love was a dominant thing people sought from their marriage. For many of us, 100 years ago and even today, it's out of reach. And people were a lot poorer in 1918, and the society was a lot more rural than it is today. And there was a broader assumption that marriage wasn't going to be this primary source of emotional fulfillment. It was true by that time that people wanted to love their spouse and they wanted to be fulfilled in their marriage, but the essential role in terms of emotional fulfillment wasn't there in the Spanish flu era as it is in the Corona era.
There is, I imagine, a lot of research on marriage in natural disasters. Can you talk about what have we seen happening with marriages in natural disasters? Are there higher divorce rates, more babies, or are those myths?
I mean, my favorite study looks at Hurricane Hugo. Some of your older listeners will remember that one. That was a major one that hit South Carolina in 1989. And one really compelling study looked at the counties in South Carolina that were declared disaster areas during the hurricane and compared them to the counties in South Carolina that were not declared disaster areas. And if you look and you can plot these things over time, what you see is a spike in divorce over the subsequent year for the people who were in the disaster areas, but not for the people who weren't. But the story is more interesting than one of just stress and national disaster always yields decline, because what you also see in those disaster area counties is you see increases in marriage rates and increases in baby rates in the subsequent year as well. So these things have large effects. These sorts of national or natural disasters have large effects on relationships, but the pattern is complex and interesting.
All right. So the coronavirus pandemic has brought a lot of very real stresses to the forefront. Not always, but usually outside of a global pandemic, when one partner has something stressful going on at work, the other person can step up. But right now, it seems like we're all stressed. So what can we do with that?
Well, it's true. There is a lot of amorphous general anxiety, even among those of us who have been spared the coronavirus and don't necessarily have loved ones with the coronavirus. The world is indeed a more dangerous place than it was before. There are broad concerns about the nature of the economy, the national economy, the world economy, and for many of us, in fact, probably most, concerns about our personal finances. And all those are coming at a time when we are forced into close proximity much more frequently than we normally would be with our significant other, with our children, again, for those of us who live with others. And here again, I would predict that you'll see a negative effect on average. That is, the average marriage or marriage-like relationship is going to suffer due to the increased stress and forced quarantine, but that some relationships will indeed benefit. And the relationships that will benefit are the ones that are able to say, this is a terrible situation, but it's also a windfall. Like if you told me 6 weeks ago that we were going to get all this time together to watch that show we've been meaning to watch or split a bottle of wine and that we used to do when we were sort of first courting and we just haven't done in a long time, those couples that can make the most of a situation like this can actually come out stronger on the other side.
And I think in the past you've talked about the idea of an expressive marriage, right? But as you said, there's so many real worries out there right now. If not health, then certainly many, if not most of us, are worried about finances. And that takes different degrees. And if people are at the point where they're worried about putting food on the table, how does that change one's ability to build the best marriage possible?
Well, it's harder. I mean, on average, it is harder to do these things when you're under stress. We all know of examples of a relationship that isn't that strong, and then somebody gets a cancer diagnosis and they draw closer together. Those cases do happen. But on average, when we're dealing with these sorts of stressors, and especially when they manifest themselves in economic stress, it is just harder to have a deep emotional connection when we are stressed, in part because the things that we're now interacting about are less fun to talk about, and in part because we have less bandwidth, less emotional bandwidth to bring to our discussions when we're discussing those difficult things. So we're going to see these sorts of problems. And I, what I hope almost all of us are at least trying to do is to be tolerant of ourselves and of our partner and to realize this is a crazy time. All of us are going through something pretty intense right now. None of us is going to be in our best behavior at all times. Let's have a little bit of a leash that we give to ourselves and to our loved ones.
Yeah, I mean, that dovetails into this idea of expectations, right? I think so many of us have so many expectations for our lives, be it our kids, our jobs, and certainly what we expect out of our partners and marriages. Is this a time to, I think, as you were just saying, sort of let go of those expectations, modify those expectations?
Yes. And I like the word modify more than let go for the reason that we were talking about earlier, right? So the idea of this, the all or nothing marriage idea, is that we're living in an era where the average marriage is worse than it would have been a couple of generations ago because our expectations have changed so that now many of us are disappointed in a marriage that would have been totally fine for our grandparents. But at the same time, the best marriages are better than they've ever been in the past. And the reason why that is because of these sorts of expectations. So high expectations are corrosive or troubling or yield less satisfaction when we're not able to adapt them to our marriage, when we're not able to live up to those sorts of expectations. But they're beneficial because they can push us in ways that our marriage may well have the ability to meet, to expect things that people weren't even trying to meet in earlier generations. And so in terms of the coronavirus, I hope that most of us are lowering expectations on most things in terms of we'll fight as little as possible, we'll never sort of quibble about cleanup or who's in charge of homeschooling the kids between 10 and 11 today. But at the same time, not forgetting those things that make our relationship special, those things that we really can use to connect, that is where we need to double down. That is where our expectations should stay high. And we should make sure that we get the glass of wine together after the kids go to bed or whatever it is that can bring us close together. So it's the blend of low expectations about the frustrations we're going to have and still high expectations about those few really special elements in our marriage or our relationship.
You know, you talked about finding those ways to connect and be at the bottle of wine or the TV series you want to catch up on. But a lot of couples, I think, connect by getting outside of the house, especially if they have kids around, maybe getting out to eat, seeing a movie. Now that those options aren't available, I mean, what else can we do? I think that's putting a strain on a lot of people, especially, you know, when you do have the dynamic of kids in the house. And I think a lot of us are kind of locked in with our children 24/7 for the first time, probably in all of our lives.
I mean, you are speaking directly to me here. And I mean, there's no way to sugarcoat the fact that a lot of the things that we like to do to stay close with our partner is to get out and do a cultural event or go to a restaurant or, I mean, a movie even. And so an enormous percentage of those are off limits. And even for those that might be on limits, it's a little harder to do when you're wearing masks. So this is where I find the observation of Marcel Proust so helpful. He said, mystery is not about traveling to new places, but about looking with new eyes. And, you know, mystery is about traveling to new places. He exaggerated the point. And the next time you can take a nice vacation with your partner and really enjoy each other in a Parisian cafe, do that. But he's right about looking with new eyes. And that's something that we have control over. The eyes that we choose to look out of, that is our perspective on the world, that's something that we have control over. And here we are, we're stuck. We're maybe stuck with you know, recalcitrant little people and you know, who don't really want to do their math homework now that they're not in the school system. And we have to watch each other fight with our children and then fight with each other over who's going to be in charge of which responsibilities at home. And yet, we have a decent amount of control over how we perceive those circumstances. Do we understand that they are temporary, that they are sort of forced on us, that these sorts of frustrations are inevitable and don't necessarily mean that the relationship is in some problematic situation? And also, can we appreciate the positive things? I mean, sometimes I'll walk into the room and my wife is reading a book to our young children, and I feel this great surge of affection for her. That didn't happen. That's like 11 a.m. when I encounter that. And so I have some choice about how I perceive the situation that exists within these four walls. And I'm doing the best I can without reaching anything near perfection to try to be generous in the way I perceive the world.
Yeah, and you've written this dovetails nicely into, I think, something you've written about before called Love Hacks. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Reorienting your thinking to try and interpret the world around us and our relationships?
That's exactly right. Like what I just described there is an example of a love hack. So I think there are three general strategies that we can use if we want to make our relationship, our marriage better. One is something that we could call going all in. And those are things like the romantic date nights, the sort of time and resource intensive sorts of things that really convey our sense of deep affection for our partner and really try to cultivate the relationship. Trying to, you know, enhance our sex life. That's another example. A second thing we can do is lowering our expectations and just saying, look, we're forever going to be incompatible about this one thing, and we just need to let it go.
Okay, we have to take a quick break here, but when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with author and social psychologist Eli Finkel. I'm Brian Mackey. Stay with us. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Eli Finkel. He's a social psychologist and professor at Northwestern University. He's also the author of The All or Nothing Marriage, How the Best Marriages Work. We talked a little earlier about the idea that natural disasters can lead to more divorce, and I've certainly heard people, other relationships experts, saying that it can sort of have a quickening effect, that if people are having doubts about their marriages, that it can sort of give this, well, life's too short kind of attitude. And I got to imagine that that's a hard thing to reconcile. Fortunately, I've never been in that position. But when do you know it's time maybe to think about saying goodbye?
Oh, boy. This one is for the moralists and the theologians, probably not the scientists. I don't think there is a moment. I think there's a judgment call that we have to make under an enormous amount of uncertainty. By the way, the same thing happens when deciding to get married in the first place. And that's going to be idiosyncratic, and I don't have the sort of ethical wherewithal to say it. On a case-by-case basis, I can look at the patterns that people are showing and say, boy, you seem to be locked into something pretty destructive, even corrosive. If you can't correct those patterns, it's hard to imagine you guys being happy together. And so I would just urge people to think in those sorts of terms. Are we bringing out the worst in each other rather than the best? Are we involved in patterns that it's almost like every time we see each other, we're you know, frustrated and angry? Are those things that we can work on? And if we've tried to work on them and failed, are they severe enough to warrant a divorce? Those are the sorts of questions that I guess people should ask.
So far, we've heard mostly about marriages and long-term partnerships, but what about singles and new couples? So how has the dating landscape, particularly the online dating landscape, changed in the past couple of months?
Yeah, so I think there are two general categories here. One is I'm single and I'd like to meet people, and under normal circumstances, I'd be on Tinder or Hinge and I'd be swiping this way or that way and I'd be going out to the bars. Those apps still exist, but face-to-face meeting is now a very dangerous thing, and far fewer people are taking those risks. And I'm glad that fewer people are taking those risks. So one question is, how are we supposed to initiate new relationships, that is to be dating, really? And there's not a definitive answer to this, although there are now a lot of services that are basically something like online speed dating. And I recommend those. Like, I think you can get a general sense of compatibility by having a little bit of you know, electronic banter or failure of electronic banter. The big question comes when it might be time to get physical, that is sexual or physical and or sexual. And now it applies not only to the people who are meeting new people, but also to the people who are involved with someone they don't live with. And look, the physical and the sexual elements of a relationship are important. That's every bit as true, if not more true, in the earliest stages. And I think what we're going to see is a whole lot of computer-mediated sexual behavior. And at the risk of alienating some proper viewers, I think we're going to see two versions of that. One is stripping online, getting naked online and having dirty talk. And the second one is something that we'll have to ask your viewers, I'm sorry, your listeners to look up, called teledildonics.
And I think we'll let them Google that themselves there to figure out what exactly that means. But I think there's some context clues. I mean, you've written in defense of Tinder. I think that was the name of an op-ed you wrote. And I mean, there are flaws with online dating, but also assets, right? I mean, is this going to be the new world for everyone now? Is this somehow accelerating this move to online dating?
Oh, I'm a big believer in online dating, not as like a better way to meet partners, but as like a really viable alternative way to meet partners. And as other ways of meeting partners, like people used to meet through work, and now that's an increasingly dangerous thing to do, as other ways of meeting partners where the boundaries are ambiguous become more complicated, I think online dating is going to become even more important than it's been in the past. The piece that I wrote about Tinder wasn't really about Tinder per se. That was about how relationship initiation works. And some people argue, including some scholars, argue that there's basically two mindsets. There's like the short-term mindset and the long-term mindset. And the argument that I made in defense of Tinder op-ed piece is that that's not the way this works for most of us most of the time. The way it works for most of us most of the time is we meet somebody and we say, huh, there's something there, I'd give that a go. And people aren't saying, I'd give it a go, and if it turned into a one-night stand, I'd be happy, but if it turned into this other thing, I'd be unhappy. They're sort of feeling it out, and they're becoming more and more intimate over time. And eventually, they'll decide, nah, that was a short-term one, or that was a long-term one. So the only thing I was really objecting to is the dichotomous way of thinking that people are in one mindset or the other mindset. In general, we're meeting people, hoping to like them, and hoping to be sexually attracted to them, and sort of open-minded at the beginning to how those things play out.
Last thing I want to ask you about before we let you go is, we've been talking about singles now and married couples before that. What about people in that kind of in-between phase, maybe new couples, or the people saying, like, in the what are we phase of their relationship before the quarantine started? Or maybe they're a new relationship, they're having to do distance for the first time. Do you have any advice for them?
Well, I mean, I sort of had them in my category earlier of them needing to figure out the nature of physical intimacy while separated. But the second really big question that I think is fascinating about the coronavirus in cases like this is, now they have to make a choice, right? Like, maybe they would not have been remotely ready to cohabit, but they're not really ready to break up either. And they're not really ready to date without ever being able to touch each other. They face this really interesting quandary and health risk, frankly, of, do we decide to cohabit as we're sort of exploring what's involved in this relationship, or do they keep their distance? And that's, again, a major quandary that's confronting people differently today than ever before.
Eli Finkel is a social psychologist and professor at Northwestern University. He's also the author of The All or Nothing Marriage: How the Best Marriages Work. Eli, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks for having me.